Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2024. I am one of your hosts, Emily St. James.
And I'm your special guest host, standing in for Estelle Getty.
There we go.
I'm Phyllis Gove.
She should be on the show.
We should get her on. We should get her on. Is she still alive?
No. All the Golden Girls are dead. Betty White was the last.
Yeah, Betty was all gone. Last girl standing.
All gone. I feel like it went Rue, B, Estelle, Betty, but I could be wrong about that.
That sounds right.
Have you seen this incredibly obviously fake promotional art for a new Golden Girls that is fooling boomers the nation over? No, seriously.
But
so many people and their parents are like, when is this coming on?
What? Who are the four?
It's Maya Rudolph, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey, and Kristen Wiig. I don't remember who the other one is.
It's the thing about it is that
I'm Lisa Kudrow as Sophia, which I don't understand.
So here's the question: are any of them old enough?
Here's the thing, Phil. I've looked this up several times.
Oh no,
you would be shocked how young the Golden Girls were when they started that show.
Really?
They were all. Mostly they were in their late 50s to early 60s. And like, okay. I used to do a thing where I would be like, if you started Golden Girls now, here's who you could cast. And it was always like Diane Lane. And you were like, what the fuck? Like, how old are Tina Fey and Amy Poehler? They're in their 40s. They're probably still a little bit too young. Oh, Tina Fey's 53. She's getting
older.
Close.
Yeah. I think Amy's around the same age. I think they're in their early.
Yeah, Amy's 52. Okay, so let's just.
And Lisa Kudrow. Choose.
Lisa Kudrow is mid 60.
Oh,
she's
wow.
60.
Okay, so she could conceivably be the eldest of the bunch.
And who's
Maya Rudolph
sure is?
Age.
Yeah,
early
she
50s?
Is 51. All right, so let's see how old Estelle Getty was when Golden Girls debuted. When Golden Girls debuted, she was 63. So okay. Like Lisa's a little bit off that, but like we're getting close.
But
you
it's,
know?
I mean, first of all, that's crazy. But also like they weren't done up to look old is kind of the thing, right? Did just people just seem older back then? Is that kind of what it was?
So like you've seen Mary Tyler Moore, right?
I have.
In like the first episode of that show, Lou Grant is like, I just turned 40. And like,
It's a hard 40 years.
Yeah. Like the thing, I do think like people genuinely, A, I think that people like things like, you know, skincare regimens, et cetera. Sure. B, smoking's a lot less common. Smoking used to like really ravage the human body. And C, I think we're just hotter now. I think that's just how it goes.
I do feel like, I mean, we are hotter, but also like, I think to your point, there's a youthfulness that's pulled deeper into your life than it was, you know?
I think about this a lot. Nobody changed my Wikipedia. I'm 2 years younger on my Wikipedia than I actually am in real life. And like they have cited that I was born when I was born, and it's 2 years after I was born. And you know what? I'm never going to change it. I actually have been like, when I turned 40.
Yes.
We're like, okay, so I turned my kid was born right before my 40th birthday on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I wanted to have happy Emily's 40th birthday on Wikipedia party. And then I had a kid. So I got to wait until I turn 50, and I'm going to have an Emily's 50th birthday on Wikipedia. And I'll secretly be 52, but nobody there will know.
Because no one's going to listen to our April Fool's episode of podcast like it's 1992. Today we're talking about two films, an obvious double bill.
I like how you reasserted control.
I mean, I think that so we pitched this on the fly.
Yeah.
During our gas food lodging episode, I believe.
Yes. I was like, okay. We were talking, I don't know why we were talking about Enchanted April. I think we were talking about like someone from that movie that should have been nominated for supporting actress. And we were like, here's Enchanted April. I've never seen it. Yeah. You had also never seen it. And I was like, April is coming up. So we got to do Enchanted April. And then I was like, well, let's do it on
April 4th.
Has our gas food lodging episode dropped, or is that coming after?
Actually, it's coming after this. It's coming after this. It's coming.
Well, you're going to get to hear all this again because I'm going to explain all of it. I was like, well, we got to do it April Fool's, and we got to pair it with something else. And somehow I landed on Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. So,
I mean, the truth of the matter is that these are two films that I don't think you and I really had any intention of covering.
I mean, These are two films about aging, which is a subject we don't like to think about.
They are about mortality.
In that the characters are all subject to the same laws of time as we are, you know?
Yes, and loneliness.
I gotta say, neither of these movies was a super big hit for me. I liked Enchanted April. Yeah. I didn't really like Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. I don't feel passionate about either of those opinions. But Joan Plowright fucking knocks it out of the park.
Deserves her Oscar nomination.
Yeah. And I remember everyone was like, she's gonna win. That was like the most common prediction. And then Marissa Tomei won. And like, I think she's this legendary actor, has never won an Oscar. She's in this great, like, Oscar-y part. I'm kind of surprised she didn't. It's just like,
Well, there's also the Laurence Olivier of it all, which everyone was like, well, you know, she was married to Olivier. So it was kind of a little bit of the Lauren Bacall thing of like, she'll thank Laurence Olivier in her acceptance speech. So won't that be nice?
Yeah. That would be great. That would have been great. Sorry to you, Joan. Joan's dead, right?
Joan's dead, I think.
She's got to be dead.
She's another one that I think looked older than she actually was when they shot Enchanted April.
Yeah. Joan Plowright. Okay, so I'm going to find out. They probably shot this in 1990. 90.
One.
You know what? She is still alive. She's 94. Come back to us, Joan.
Go, Joan.
When she shot this, probably I'd say in 90, she would have been 61. So yeah,
this is some Estelle Getty shit. Estelle Getty, who's rocking a dye job, maybe in this movie. Hard to say.
Yeah, to be clear, in Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, not Enchanted April. Though I gotta say, I think if Estelle Getty and Joan Plowright had switched roles, they could have, both of them would have been great in the other film.
I absolutely agree with you 100%.
Can you imagine if Stallone's mom was just like Tony, British actress, just like, hello, my son, Sylvester? And he was like,
I like that Joan Plowright sounds like Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah. Hello, I'm Joan Plowright.
So I'm going to give a synopsis of both of these films off the bat so that we don't feel adhered to. We can just do whatever we want or no.
Just alternate sentences. So
Jesus
that
Christ. Enchanted April, when married British woman Rose, played by Miranda Richardson, and Lottie, played by Josie Lawrence, decide to take a break from their respective spouses. They stay at a castle in Italy for a quiet holiday. Joining the ladies is Carolyn Dester and young socialite Mrs. Fisher. Is she a young? Ooh. Oh, no, sorry. Yeah, Carolyn Dester, a young socialite, and Mrs. Fisher, an older aristocrat, liberated from their daily routines. The four women ease into life in rural Italy, and each finds herself transformed by the experience. Enchanted April opened on July 31st, 1992, against Death Becomes Her, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, A League of Their Own, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and, of course, The Mighty Ducks. It will go on to make $13 million.
Classic summer release.
Classic summer release. It's got 85% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 84% from audiences. Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Smarting from a romantic breakup, macho police detective Joe Bumowski, played by Sylvester Stallone, gets a cross-country visit from his mother, Tootie, played by Estelle Getty. Her misguided efforts to help only fray his nerves, but that doesn't stop him, just stop her from nagging Joe to become more open about his feelings towards his ex-girlfriend and current boss, Lieutenant Gwen Harper, played by Joe Beth Williams. When Tootie witnesses a brutal multiple murder, she takes her meddling to the extreme by tagging along to help her son solve the case. Stop Where My Mom Will Shoot opened on February 1st, 1992, against Medicine Man, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Final Analysis, and obviously The Mighty Ducks. It would go on to make $70 million worldwide on a $45 million budget. It's got 14% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 21% from audiences.
I think that's a little low. You know, I would not recommend. You? I would not recommend that film at all. But yeah. I feel like there should be 7% more critics who would. I feel, you know, like 21.
This
is fine.
Ebert's review of this movie, which, I mean, listen, Ebert is a can be a witchy mistress sometimes in terms of just unsure as to why he does what he does, and sometimes he just clowns on movies because it makes him feel good because he has to watch bad movies a lot of the time.
Yeah,
he gave this half a star. I'm not sure I've ever seen him give half a star before.
Yeah,
like that's low even for him. He finds something redeeming.
I think I saw him give no stars one time, and I don't remember what that was for. It was for, but like I feel like, okay, so at the AV Club.
Sure.
We used to be like D minus is secretly the worst grade. It's a worse grade than F, because F you give to a thing that is such a colossal failure. It's kind of fun to watch, or something that had such ambitions and falls so short of them that you just get to watch the hubris of it. D minus is like, there's just nothing in this. It's just kind of,
am I right that you rated the Glee Rocky Horror Picture Show episode an F?
I did. I think I did.
I vaguely remember an F for that.
Everyone remembers the screen cap I made Miles McNutt make of his
incredible
Will Schuster's face, which is now like a meme, which is like fun
straight
for me.
To camera.
Yeah. One of the things, like toward the end of my time at the AV Club, they switched over the CMS. So you would do the letter grade and then you'd be able to pull down plus or minus if you wanted to add one. And for a while you could give an F plus or an F minus. And I discovered this little bug and was like, oh my God, I know that the next episode of American Horror Story is just like a colossally wild time. I'm going to give it an F plus and the world's going to fall apart. And then there was like, it was like, I realized this before the holiday break. Right. And then I come back from holiday break and American Horror Story, I'm like, that is an F plus episode if ever I've seen one. And they had fixed the bug. So I had to give it a B minus. Because I was like, well, I'm not going to give it an F because it's not an F episode. It's an F plus episode.
It's an F plus
qualitatively is actually a B minus. So,
I mean, Ebert gave us a half star. So if he did give a zero star to something, I guess that's something.
I think, yeah, how I got here is I think zero stars is Ebert's F, and a half star is like, I can see giving this a half star more than I can see giving it two stars, but I think a half star is a little unfair.
I mean, he said, Stop Where My Mom Will Shoot is one of those movies so dim-witted, so utterly lacking in even the smallest morsel of redeeming value that you stare at the screen in stunned disbelief.
I watched this Monday because I was like, I'm going to get out ahead of some things.
Yeah.
So I watched it. I don't remember a fucking thing that happens in this movie, except when Sylvester Stallone says stop or my mom will shoot.
Hey, I mean, that's the there name are some of the things show. That actually did stay with me in this movie. And, I mean, the dream sequence of him in a diaper.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, his girlfriend and his mother talk about changing him. Is some Oedipal shit.
I mean, I think that that is, I think that that is just how it goes sometimes. You just like, I think that at some point, Save the Cat writer Blake Snyder was like, change has multiple meanings, and one of them has to do with diapers. I don't know. Like,
I don't know.
I could see a version of that gag. I can see a version of that gag working, but yeah, no.
Part of the problem is, I mean, there's lots of problems with that film, but it does sort of feel like you're just watching it kind of like, why does this exist? Do you know what I mean? Like, who is this movie for? And who knows if it's even urban legend at this point, but there's the whole like Schwarzenegger thing, how he circled this script as a prank to see if Stallone would do it, and then Stallone did it, and Stallone was like, I don't know, this is the worst movie I've ever done, blah blah blah. Like, Stallone, he was in a weird period where he was trying to do comedies because Schwarzenegger was succeeding in comedy and Stallone was not.
Yeah, the thing about Schwarzenegger is he intuitively understood a comedy, that the comedy of him is mostly visual. Mm-hmm. Like, he obviously can do one-liners, you know, but like, they have to be pretty compact.
Yep.
What is funny is here he is with Danny DeVito. Just the visual of that is funny.
Yep.
Here he is with a bunch of little kids. Yep. The visual of that is funny. Here he is pregnant. The visual of that is terrifying, but also funny, you know? And like, I'm obviously not all of his these comedies too. Worked. Yeah.
Right? His like, voice is the accent and the like, it's not a tumor. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff is funny too.
Yeah, and like Stallone, there's nothing inherently funny about him.
No.
So like, although I think he could have gotten away with doing something a little bit more in the verbal comedy range. You know, he was like a very good dramatic actor before he became Sylvester Stallone. He's fantastic in the first Rocky. He's fantastic in Creed. Like, he can really hit those notes when he wants to. So I would not be surprised if he could have done some more verbal comedy. But like, I do think to some extent, when you are a guy who's known that much for action, you kind of need to do the big sight gag thing. And obviously The Rock and Vin Diesel have both done that. It's happened over the years. And like, I think that this is Stallone's version of that. But it's just like, it's not as funny because the mom is a character in a way that like a child isn't. Obviously, the kids in Kindergarten Cop are all characters, but they're all like just tiny children. And for this to work, you have to like think about mother and son relationships. And it's just like there's a layer of verisimilitude that the film has to hit that it just kind of doesn't. I also think it's better than a half star.
It's better than a half star. I mean,
digging in my heels.
I do think that Stallone, like, I think he's funny in Tango and Cash. I think he's funny in Demolition Man. He knows how to deliver a funny, like a legitimately funny joke. There are very few funny jokes in this movie. So that's on top of everything else that he's being sort of like, you know, sent down the river. I do think that Stallone is just ultimately, there's just not as much like, real estate, if you will, that he can actually inhabit, unlike Schwarzenegger, where you can put him in different scenarios because he understands what's funny about him in a way that Stallone does not.
Have you ever talked about Sylvester Stallone on either of these shows?
We talked about Tango and Cash is the only on the 89 Patreon. We talked
on the 89. Okay. All right. I feel like, so there's that year 85.
Yep.
When he famously has Rocky IV and Rambo II, and they're both massive. And then I feel like everyone just got tired of him all at once.
Well, he also just kept doing the same things. He really wasn't showing any sort of diversity of tone. So
yeah. And really, I guess it's also like, you know, after 85, he does Cobra in 86, yep. which I think was a small hit.
Yep.
And then Over the Top, which is like a famously bad movie.
Yep.
But yeah, he really is like, he does kind of step back. He's making like one movie a year, which is obviously a fairly like brisk clip. Yep. But certainly, you know, when Schwarzenegger's like swooping in and like stealing a lot of that thunder, because as this is happening is, you know, Commando, Predator, some of the foundational Schwarzenegger things. But they talked a little bit about this on the last Action Hero episode mm-hmm. of Blank Check. And Schwarzenegger's reign is also similarly short. We remember these guys as like yeah. huge titans, and they did have like 2 to 3 year periods when they were mm-hmm. and then the rest of the time they were just like pretty big, and then the fall off was very quick.
Yep.
It's they had the same arc. It's fascinating.
And very much around the same time. It's the 80s and very early 90s, and then it's kind of done. I mean, I think yeah. the other factor in all of this with Stallone is he's writing his shit.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously he writes Rocky, which is a great fucking script, and like it's amazing. A great movie.
Yeah.
But it gives him the ego, or whatever you want to call it, to be a writer on so many of his projects and to be sort of creatively in control of them. And the reality is there's just not a ton of range that he has as a writer. Like, I'm looking at this stuff where it's like, you mentioned, obviously, you know, you've got Rockies, the various Rockies, you have the various Rambos. But then, like, he tries to. Rhinestone is a real moment when he yeah. takes a swing and it's a big fucking failure. And I think, had that worked, he would have found the dexterity that Schwarzenegger had. But since it didn't, he falls right back into people don't want that from me. So yeah. then it's like, it's Rambo First Blood, it's Rocky IV, it's Cobra, Over the Top, Rambo, Lockup, like all these just feel very much just. And the funny thing is that, like, and I think they mentioned this on Blank Check as well, which is he has these two duds in Oscar and Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, when everyone's just like, don't fucking do that, we don't want that from you. And then he does Cliffhanger, which he's a co-writer on, and it does way better than Last Action Hero, because people are just like, yeah, I'll watch Stallone climb mountains. I mean, that seems yeah. like a thing that I'd want to do. And then Demolition Man is a marginal success, but that's kind of the end of the road. I mean, after that, Copland is the movie that people think like could have been an Oscar play kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then that's it.
Yeah, he's in the wilderness like, there. He's in the wilderness there for Creed. A while. Yeah. Like, he, yeah. I mean, people, I think, remember Judge Dredd fondly in the set, because, sure. but I think like they just sort of remember some of the one-liners. It's not a very good movie. I actually think Daylight, his like disaster movie, is pretty like fun for those like yeah. mid-90s disaster movies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm looking at he just it's yeah. rough.
The Expendables obviously were successful, and that was kind of his brainchild. But
yeah,
you know, I can't really ride for those movies.
I mean, they're bad. So I found like I was doing. I don't know why I was. Oh, I was on the Stopper My Mom Will Shoot Wikipedia page.
Sure.
And there's a thing in there that's like, he says it's the movie he most regrets doing.
Yes.
Or when he was asked about movies he regrets doing, this is the first one he said.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is the link? Like, okay, let me go see what this source is. And he did an interview with, this is a throwback, Ain't It Cool News, oof, in 2006, which was, they had the
Libby.
Hello to Libby.
Hello to Libby.
Hey, to say a little bit about Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
Nope. And she's gone.
So they did this interview on Ain't It Cool News, which was the various people in the talkbacks. This is a fun thing. Do you know that Ain't It Cool News invented the comment section?
It did not.
It did.
Really?
It did. The comment,
the first website,
the
to have
first
comments?
Site. To ever have comments was Ain't It Cool News. Like, you can blend, like, I've been listening to this excellent podcast called Download, the History of Ain't It Cool News, which is basically the thesis is everything that's wrong with the world is Ain't It Cool News as well.
I mean, first of all, that I didn't know that about the comment section, but like, it is notoriously the first movie blog website.
It wasn't the first, but it was definitely like the big one. Yeah. You know, it was the one that broke through, partially because Harry Knowles was such a like larger than life figure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they did an interview in 2006. They had the commenters submit questions and Stallone answered them. And I read all, because they did it in like five parts. I read all of them.
So it's like
and
a that's Reddit where, feed, kind of.
Yeah, it's like an AMA, basically. Yeah. They also invented the AMA, maybe? I don't know. But like, it's just like, yes, the answer about how he doesn't like Stop or My Mom Will Shoot is on there. And he lists like 8 or 9 projects where he's like, I just don't think that's a very good movie. And I'm like, sly, buddy. But my favorite is in one of them, I gotta look this up because I sent it to Libby. He talks about someone is asking him, okay, rank the Rocky movies, because this is he's doing promo for Rocky Balboa, the 6th and final Rocky movie before it becomes Creed.
Sure.
And so they're like, rank the Rocky movies, which are your favorites? He says, the Rocky films have been part of an incredible journey that has taken me to some great heights and depths, but overall, I feel incredibly grateful to be associated with such a noble character. As for ranking them in order of personal preference, that is going to be difficult. I know everyone assumes the original Rocky would be my favorite, but I have to say that the last Rocky, Rocky Balboa, was the most emotional and fulfilling journey of all the Rocky films. Okay, he's promoting that film, maybe it's because I've learned to appreciate what is really valuable in life, which is the love of others, and what is the most terrifying, which is the prospect of a life filled with loneliness. So, I rank Rocky Balboa my favorite. Now he ranks the rest of the series, and this is where this becomes funny. Then Rocky 2, Rocky 3, Rocky 4, and Rocky 5 rounds out the series. It's like he literally forgot he was ranking them. It was just like, I'm going to list the 5 Rocky movies, all of which are just Rocky with the number after them.
Like, that's pretty fantastic. I actually like that. It's a good bit. He's like, I actually just do it in sequence.
The thing that makes it funniest is rounds out the series. It's like, yes, no shit. No shit. The 5th movie out of, yeah.
I mean, I think that, I'll say this. Did you watch the Schwarzenegger Netflix documentary series?
No.
I think you'd like it. It's 3 parts. I found it surprisingly interesting. As a guy, like, I've never been an 80s action guy. So like, this is just stuff that just doesn't really speak to me that much. But seeing Schwarzenegger's arc as a human was fascinating and sort of, you know, I didn't know a lot. I mean, I don't even think I knew that that it was like a runoff, like that it was a special election that he won. And that's the only reason.
Davis. That he,
So like, which I was just like, oh, right, because he would never have made it through the primaries. The only way he could win is by it being a special election. It's amazing.
No, like the thing is, like at the time, the California Republican Party still had some juice, but they were very much a moderate Republican Party, which they're not anymore. Now they're so conservative they can't win a statewide election. Like they haven't in forever, because the state is the voting body of the state is more progressive than they are, which is like sections of the state keep trying to secede from the state.
Right.
But Schwarzenegger, you know, he's pretty moderate. He's one of the classic fairly libertarian Republicans where he like wants the government to stay out of your bedroom and also your pocketbook, which is whatever. Like I like strong social services, but whatever. But like I think he probably could have won a primary, but it definitely was like him slipping in through this like random procedural bullshit. That's was like thing. Kind of appropriate.
And it was it's a short window is the thing, right? Like he probably would have won a primary, but like as you if you watch the documentary series, but as the series sort of explores, he kind of gets hit with a bunch of sexual harassment allegations, but it's right near the end of the window, basically. So he's able to kind of ride the storm. Whereas had that been a thing that went over 6, 8, 10 months, he would have just gotten understandably beaten by it.
Yeah. And like, you know, I was working at a newspaper out in Riverside for the 2006 gubernatorial election. So like he was courting editorial board endorsements. I don't remember who he was running against, some real fucking milquetoast, whoever.
Sure, yeah.
But so I once rode in an elevator with him because he was there trying to get the editorial board to endorse him, which of course they were going to. We had a very conservative editorial board. So they were going to, but like I was once on an elevator with him and I was just like, here we are. Well, he had his people with him, so I wasn't going to, like, you know, right. He was very large and he was like in a suit. He was looking very industrious. He was doing everything he could not to look at me. And I wanted to like make a joke or say something. I just wanted to make him laugh, but I was so intimidated. Mm. And then finally, as the elevator door was opening, I was like, do I know you from somewhere?
That's and a then, good joke.
And then he was like, and then he like left.
Anyway, you gotta laugh.
My newspaper endorsed him is the point of this story.
I think that ultimately what I found kind of interesting is that I don't think you'd ever see Stallone ever do a documentary series about himself. Like he is not.
I thought you were going to say run for governor. And well, I was like, I don't think he's got the juice.
I don't think he has the juice. The Riz, if you will. I just not to sort of belabor this comparison, but I think it is worth noting because it just jumps off the screen at you as you're watching Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, how limited he is as a star, as a movie presence. It's because the truth is that if Schwarzenegger had made Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, I bet that movie would have been fine. Like
it would have been better. Yeah.
Right. Like he would have been able to make it work. And Stallone just is not capable of it.
You know who could have been elected governor of California?
Mm.
Estelle Getty.
100%.
Yeah. She's
who
got
would
it.
Have voted for it. She's got it. I mean, this is the thing. This movie is one joke, right? It's like, what if Estelle Getty was Sylvester Stallone's mom, right? Like,
yes.
it's a one joke movie. You know, I found it pretty lazy and just sort of also really, really dated even for 92. Like right? Like, didn't it feel like the type of movie that like could have been in the 60s or 70s?
Oh, sure. Like, I think one of the things that's dated about it is the 80s are the great decade of here's a movie about like gender roles.
Yeah.
What are they now? And like we've always had gender roles. What are they now movies? It's like the foundation of a lot of comedy. I do think like part of the reason comedy is struggling right now is because we don't have as hard and fast of defined as gender roles as we used to. And like, I mean, I think that's a good thing, but also like it comedy sort of relies on a shared understanding of, you know, how the world functions. And increasingly we don't have that shared understanding, which is tearing us apart as a country, but also has made the major studio comedy kind of bad. But like the movie that worked was Barbie, which is about gender roles. Yeah. So this proves
it's
my
interesting.
Point.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, this movie is like a movie about, oh boy, you know, men don't like their moms and they like to live in a house where they can keep the toilet seat up. What would happen if they fell in love with a girl and their mom wanted them to get married? It's just like it's such a 1983 premise, you know?
It's so antiquated.
It's a Mr. Mom ass movie.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, it's very kind of it's kind of sad, actually. Like at its core, it's a somewhat sad movie about, you know, a mom who's scared that her son is never going to kind of elevate to some sort of social standards that we have.
Yeah.
Or she has anyway. And it's also kind of about a woman in the role of Jo Beth Williams that's like trying to get this guy to actually like function in an emotional relationship in some sort. Can we talk about Jo Beth Williams for a second? Because I was so pained watching her in this. Yes.
Hold on. Before we talk about Jo Beth Williams, which we should, I have IMDb open to Estelle Getty's page.
Yes. Yes.
But I have the Zoom open over it. So all I'm seeing is like the side and it's just Florence Pugh in Dune 2 with her weird little like hairnet thing coming over. Do you think I could pull that look off? I think
yes,
I could.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, great. Yeah, okay. Sure. Jo Beth Williams.
So Joe Beth Williams, who is in Kramer versus Kramer in a smaller role. That's the, her first role. And then literally 2 years later, 3 years later, she's in Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. And she fucking rules in that movie. And it and then The Big Chill is the year after. And you're just like, she should have had, the world should have been her fucking oyster. And yeah. It just never happens for her.
Yeah,
and it bums me the fuck out.
I don't think that choosing this film was the greatest decision she ever made, but
I mean, listen, got bills to pay.
No, I get it. I get why you, again, I think everything about this movie makes sense on paper.
Sure.
And but it's one of those things I think about a lot with like Blacklist scripts. Mm-hmm. Like a Blacklist script often succeeds. A, because the quality of the writing is undeniable, you know, sure. Or B, because it has like a premise that you hear it and you're like, ooh, like one of the classic Blacklist scripts is Passengers, the Jennifer Lawrence, Chris Pratt movie. Sure. And you hear that and you're like, oh, that's cool. And the script is cool. And then you see it and you're like, wait, actually seeing this is kind of terrible.
Awful.
It makes me feel awful. Yeah. And like, I do think Stop or My Mom Will Shoot has a, like, you hear that and you're like, oh, that's a movie. And then you see it and you're like, oh no, that's one scene of a movie.
It's an SNL sketch. Yeah. It's
yeah,
exactly what it is. It's there's nothing. I mean, again, I think that if they took, first of all, three writers wrote this, you know, if they took the time to actually build out the world a little bit, dig a little bit of deeper and a little deeper into the characters, figure out some more conflicts that could happen, there's a movie there, right? I mean, in theory, Kindergarten Cop is also an SNL sketch. What if Stallone had a bunch of kids he had to fucking teach? And yet that movie does the legwork to build out the fucking crimes, to build out all that sort of stuff so that it feels like a movie. Like, again, this is kind of just screenwriting 101.
And it's also like the premise of Kindergarten Cop automatically suggests two workplaces.
Yes.
And you're like, okay. Yep. I got all kinds of like directions this could go. You could see a version of that movie where he has to become like like over the process of this, he becomes a good teacher.
Totally.
He realizes how much he loves kids or whatever. Like Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, you're backed into a corner.
Yep.
It's, you know, there's just like, unless, and again, I think any premise can make a great movie. Mm-hmm. Unless you have like the like greatest mother-son relationship that you've like put a lot of attention to, but this just falls back on cliches about mother-son relationships in a way that is, you know, just kind of annoying. I think that cliche is fine in a story structure that is involving, mm-hmm. but this movie kind of doesn't like put in the work, you know. Well,
if you compare it to the other Roger Spottiswood classic, Turner and Hooch,
oh my god, so much better.
but again, a one joke movie, right? Which also has a thin crime story. Like, and it just goes to show that, like, well, first of all, like, put a dog in anything and it works. But I also just feel like Hanks's persona at that time is working. There's a really lovely love story with Mayor Winningham. Like, all that stuff is kind of working.
At the time, that movie was not that well received. It has become like people love it now. I love that movie. Sure. It's, you know, the
it's
dog
a masterpiece
is great.
In comparison to Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
Yeah. But it is like, it is very much like that movie at least has a relationship mm-hmm. that they have put the work into, which is granted, man and a dog, which is one of the hardest relationships to screw up because people like dogs. Yes. People are like, look at that dog. And, you know, when Hooch die, as Dino De Laurentiis said about King Kong, when Hooch die, everybody cry. But like,
it's true.
Yeah, I think that Turner and Hooch does put in the work on that central relationship,
which
is why it's endured. It's not like Stop or My Mom Will Shoot is remembered that fondly by people who rented it at the video store when they were nine. You know,
it's 100%. I also think that. There is something to be said for the fact that, and I breezed past it here when I gave this the context, but they spent $45 million on Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Okay. Now, admittedly, Stallone's price tag at that point must have been 12 or 15, is my guess, or something in that vicinity.
I mean, Estelle was commanding like 16. Like,
let's just say let's just take 20 off the top, right? Just for above the line, just for what it's worth.
Yeah.
So now you're left with $25 million. Turner and Hooch cost 13 and it made 71, right? So you're just like, this is not hard, guys. You just like
Turner and Hooch looks better than this movie.
It does.
Despite having the same director. Yeah. It just like, it has better locations. Absolutely. It just has like, this movie is like, I guess maybe they spent $3 million on the adult diaper, but like this movie's like, it was shot in my neighborhood. It was shot in downtown LA. I recognized a lot of the locations, sure. And I was always like, there's a better location two blocks away, my dude. Yeah, sure. And granted, I don't know what my neighborhood looked like in 1992 because I lived on a farm. But like, you know, I watched that movie being like, this is the most unimaginative stuff you could possibly. I'm 100%. Gonna look this up and find out it was filmed in Vancouver or something.
I do think, though, you know, it's interesting because as uninteresting as this movie is to look at for basically 95% of it, there is an action sequence at the end of this film that did make me go like, oh, that's why he got the Bond movie, which is you have this the mom gets kidnapped and she's about to be, I don't know, taken somewhere in an airplane. They don't really tell us where she's going. So Stallone has to stop the plane from taking off. So he has this big tanker truck that he essentially sort of hobbles the plane with. And as far as action sequences go, it's not a bad one. Like, it's competently done. And I was like, well, this must have cost some money to do this.
Yeah.
And that was when I was just like, this is, because up until that point, I was like, why did this guy even get the Bond role? Like, what? How did they even get, like, why? And then you watch this and you're like, okay, I guess he can probably do it.
I don't think any of the action sequences in this are like particularly good, but like, I get why, you know, why they work, I guess, would be the best way to put it. Like, they're you know, that the airplane sequence is good. Sure. The shootout is pretty good. The scene where Stallone says stop or my mom will shoot is pretty good, you know. Like, all of that is anonymous, but like perks the movie up. But yeah, Roger Spottiswoode, like, he doesn't go directly from this to
in between, something called Mesmer, which I don't know what that is, with Alan Rickman, a Canadian British German biological film, biographical.
It's probably about mesmerism. Yeah, Bill, we gotta watch it.
Francis,
we gotta watch it.
94.
Let's scrap all our plans. Do podcasts like it's 94. We start with Mesmer.
It is interesting though that Spottiswoode does direct Schwarzenegger in The Sixth Day, a movie that doesn't exist, basically. But we're cloning Schwarzenegger and we're spending $82 million on it.
I always think that's End of Days, a non-existent Schwarzenegger movie I kind of like. It's fun. Tomorrow Never Dies, which is, you know how like when you're like, I got to name a Bond movie, that's the one I can never think of. You know, just like Tomorrow Never Dies.
You know, they did the Brosnan Bonds on Blank Check's Patreon earlier this year, maybe late last year. Can't really remember. So I was kind of rewatching them a little bit and I couldn't finish Tomorrow Never Dies. I was just like, this movie's boring as fuck. Like, it's just not. And again, like, it's 97 and I sort of get what it's trying to be, kind of this commentary on Murdoch and the news being the 24-hour news cycle and all of that. But Michelle Yeoh and Brosnan don't have any chemistry, unfortunately. She's great, but like, they don't make sense together. You got Terry Hatcher as the Bond girl. It's just and like Jonathan Pryce, who's doing a great job as the kind of villain, but it's just not a good movie.
I like that also Roger Spottiswoode is one of the many people to have done a Ripley movie, meaning the character of Tom Ripley from Talented Mr. Ripley. So many people have made Ripley stories because I'm guessing all those books' rights were sold separately. He's like, you know who you cast as the other people who played Ripley at this point are Alain Delon, Dennis Hopper, Matt Damon, and John Malkovich, all like, you know, interesting, nervy guys. And he cast Barry Pepper, who's a good actor, but I'm like, does not scream Ripley to me.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew Scott, who's now in a Ripley show on Netflix, makes sense as Ripley for a bunch of reasons.
For sure.
But I don't, you know, it's so interesting to me that Ripley is this kind of enduring character. But at the same time, there's like, it hasn't ever really connected. Like, as much as Talented Mr. Ripley, the 99 movie, has in hindsight become this, you know, one of the better movies of 99. And everyone kind of looks back on it and says, like, we didn't know what we had in 99 with this movie. I don't feel like Ripley is a role or a character that people are like all that familiar with or care that much about.
I mean, the Ripley movie that really made a mark and connected with the culture was Saltburn. So,
I mean, for like, real though. Yeah. I just want to see if there's anything else that I want to. The jaunty score in Stopper, My Mom Will Shoot.
Also, I do feel, I mean, Alan Silvestri, it's crazy. Dude.
It's crazy.
I do feel like it pops up in like trailers and stuff. It's like kind it's like kind of a generic comedy score in a way that, like, you know how Curb Your Enthusiasm and It's Always Sunny are scored entirely with like studio tracks that they like cut off a CD somewhere? It has that feel. Yeah.
I also just want to say that there was an interview with Stallone that I grabbed a clip from that I think is an interesting thing. You can take it for what it's worth. Stopper, My Mom Will Shoot was supposed to be like Throw Mama from the Train with the mom as this really nasty piece of work. Instead, you hire the nicest woman in Hollywood, Estelle Getty, who you wish was your mother. That's the end of that. Also, I'd heard Schwarzenegger was going to do the movie and I said, I'm going to beat him to it. I think he set me up. What? I mean,
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I guess there's a there's a Danny DeVito-esque version of this, a nastier version of this, where it's more of a dark comedy, I guess. But I don't know how that works really either, quite honestly. So I don't know what to make of that, but that's what Stallone's. It seems a little bit like he's trying to kind of retcon it, but who knows?
How do you feel about Lucinda Barrett?
I don't know. I think I know who that is.
Jacinda Barrett. I don't know.
The actress?
Yeah, the actress.
She's fine.
Why am I thinking about? Oh, because she's in Ripley Underground.
I was like, what the hell are we talking about?
Sorry.
Couple things worth noting here. Ving Rhames, Richard Schiff, Roger Rees, pretty stellar cast in this movie.
This cast is the supporting players, just like the random the randos who drop by. It's like, yeah, it does have that feel of like when you're watching a movie from the 2000s and Octavia Spencer just drops in.
Yeah,
Like, oh my, I feel like that way about a lot of movies in this period. Richard Schiff will just show up and you're like, hey, it's Richard Schiff.
It's Richard Schiff. Roger Rees with a wobbly accent. Just let the man speak in his normal British accent. What are we doing here? Like, just very strange. I mean, outside of that, you know, 2D singing her son to sleep. I mean, again, this is just weird shit. There's just a lot of like this is just I don't like this. But what this movie does have, and you texted me this, is another joke freeze frame ending. Do you want to expound on that for a second?
Oh my god, again, this movie's falling on my brain. I know it's Stallone's face and he's just like making a face. It's like, oh my god, my mom, she's at it again. Yeah,
the joke is that at the end of this film they're at the airport and Tootie recognizes a man from America's Most Wanted.
Yes.
And the last joke is, I know why I remembered him, he shot his mother. And then Stallone makes a face like wah, wah, and then they go to freeze frame.
They were clearly setting up the sequel, Stop, I Shot My Mom, but never got to make it.
Stop or I'll shoot my mother. Yeah, so that happened. You want to rate this before we talk about Enchanted April?
Sure, 21. I gave that number earlier.
21 sounds right. I'll go with the 21, sure.
Good, 21.
All right. So Enchanted April. So Enchanted April is a weird movie. And you texted me before I watched it that about the quality of the Pluto TV transfer.
It's, yeah, the quality of the prints you can see this movie on are pretty bad. And we did some research into why that is. But
it was shot on 16.
Yeah, it was shot on 16. It was shot for television. Yes. So a lot of the framing is very strange.
Very strange.
I'm guessing that they ported it over to film because it's quite, you know, it's quite well acted. It has a very good cast. It is, as far as these things go, kind of smart counter programming in an art house sense. It's kind of just like a slight but enjoyable, mostly comedic in tone movie about, you know, that has some nice Italian footage. Like, we're gonna have some vistas, we're gonna have some beautiful costumes, we're gonna have some, you know, beautiful landscapes. But yeah, like there's some really strange close-ups. The level of grayness when they're in London at the start is obviously enhanced to underscore we're going to go somewhere beautiful and sunny, but is so gray. And I think that's a function of the print. And I'm also guessing, like, nobody's gone in to restore Enchanted April, you know, because it's a Miramax movie. So that means it's probably in like a weird legal situation.
Sure. You know, this was a movie that I think I kind of knew existed solely because I know that Joan Plowright got the Oscar nomination. So I knew that this movie existed.
It's got like three nominations. It's wild. Yeah,
it is wild. It's also one of those films that, doing the, you know, the scant amount of research I did for this episode, this is basically Miramax's first movie. So Miramax kind of rolls the dice on this kind of class, what would ultimately become kind of a classic part of their company, which is this sort of lighthearted period piece that would, you know, that Academy voters would like, you know what I mean? That type of stuff.
Yeah.
And so they go all in on this movie. I don't know if I'm assuming Miramax just distributed it in North America is my assumption.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. They, go ahead.
There's a British company that blows it up to 35 and puts it on movie screens.
Yeah.
After it airs on the BBC as a television show or a miniseries or however they decide to. I'm amazed that this movie was allowed to be nominated for Oscars considering that it already played on television. But I guess since it didn't play on domestic television is why.
I believe that was weird. Yeah, I believe that was a rule for a long time. I do like, so like it does feel to me like they saw. So in 1989, they're nominated for their first ever Oscars for My Left Foot.
Yes.
And that's the year of Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Yes. And I think they were like, Sex, Lies, and Videotape is going to be our big thing. It's going to get us our first Best Picture nomination, et cetera, et cetera. Instead, it's My Left Foot. And they're like, oh, British people. And that's like that's their whole thing from there on out.
The success of, I mean, obviously this is a step-by-step process for all intents and purposes to kind of get us to The Crying Game, which ultimately is the movie that is successful enough and blows them up enough that kind of sets them on the trajectory. That and Reservoir Dogs wasn't them, right? Or was it them?
They distributed it theatrically in the US only. But it did.
That
was how they built
the,
That's how they built their relationship. Yeah.
So it's just interesting to sort of see how, as you just sort of said, they think that Sex, Lies, and Videotape is going to be the big hit. It ultimately is not, although it does get a screenplay nomination. And then you have My Left Foot, Enchanted April, and then sort of The Crying Game. It is interesting that Enchanted April ultimately is kind of the success story that allows them the money to buy Crying Game.
I'm looking at the movies Miramax released in 1992, and it's just such a fun,
what,
like, random collection. Well, like, Obviously, there's a lot of them, but I'm just going to read some of the highlights. American Dream, which is one of the a great Barbara Kopple documentary.
Okay.
Delicatessen, which we've talked about on this very show. K2, which is mountain climbing drama with really high production values. They only distributed it. So obviously Enchanted April. Incident at Oglala, a great Michael Apted documentary. Something called Johnny Suede. Stars Brad Pitt.
I do know that
movie. Here's the one that was Bob Roberts, which we've covered here. Mm-hmm. Breaking the Rules, which is kind of well known. Reservoir Dogs, Crying Game, etc. It's a Passion Fish. But the one I was really drawn to is Freddy as FRO7, a British animated musical action fantasy comedy film written and directed by John Asevsky and starring the voice of Ben Kingsley. Inspired by bedtime stories, as Asevsky told to his son about his favorite toy frog working as a secret agent. Phil, we got to cover this film.
That sounds fucking interesting.
It's a parody of
James
Bond.
What is that?
Here's the first sentence. Here are the first two sentences of this plot summary.
Okay.
In the Middle Ages, 10-year-old Prince Frederick is orphaned when his evil aunt Messina kills his parents in hopes of taking the throne for himself. Rather than killing the young prince, Messina transforms himself into a frog.
I'm in. Are you in?
It is about an immortal frog secret agent whose parents died in the Middle Ages.
Who's voiced by Ben Kingsley?
Voiced by Ben Kingsley. Brian Blessed and Jonathan Pryce are the other.
That's fantastic. What do you... I'm curious. I'm sure there's an answer to this, and I'm trying to sort of scan this but I'm never going to figure it out. But what's the first movie that Miramax bankrolls?
Freddy as FRO7 was the lowest grossing animated film at the U.S. box office from 1992 to 2007, when it was taken over by a different Ben Kingsley voiced film, The Ten Commandments. Anyway, sorry. What was the first...
What do you think was the first Miramax bankrolled movie? Because like most of their business is distribution, right? So they're buying already made films. Like they're just going to festivals and they're just, but I'm assuming that Pulp Fiction's got to be up there, right? Like I'm assuming that they bankroll that movie, right?
It's actually way earlier than you would think.
Okay.
Here's the thing people forget about Miramax. It's obviously Harvey, but it's also Bob. And Bob's just making cheap ass horror movies, a lot of them returning profits. So the first, as far as I can tell, the first movie they financed is in 1981. It's called The Burning. It's a slasher film.
Okay.
And they didn't distribute it. It was distributed by a different company, but they did fund it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Fair enough. There's a lot of these movies in the 80s where Harvey's buying up foreign films that he can put. A stamp of quality on.
Sure.
And Bob is just like, I have $5. I'm going to make a movie about an Easter bunny who's evil. And you're like, great.
Had you read The Enchanted April?
No, and I wish I had, because it comes from one of my favorite subgenres of writing, which is these ladies are going on vacation. Let's see what happens.
I was watching this film and I was just like, there's a swath of this film, probably 15 minutes, where they're just lying in the sun. And I'm just like, good for you. I love this for you.
This is kind of in the US, we've smashed this up with the romantic comedy.
It's true.
I'm reading, I'm kind of struggling through Emily Henry is one of my favorite writers. I'm kind of struggling through her latest, which is literally we're going to go on a vacation and have some, but it's also a rom-com. But in Britain, there is this rich tradition of, I think it's because of the class system there. I have a friend who has access to a wonderful house somewhere else. All of us are going to go. We don't really know each other, but we're going to go stay in this house. Some of us will find love. Some of us will just have a nice time. One of us is an old lady and she's going to think about her life. This is an established genre of novel there. I was fascinated to watch this because I recently read a book called I finished it days before I watched this movie. It's called Winter Solstice. Also, they're very frequently tied to specific times of the year. Mm-hmm. So it is a holiday book. It's about these people who go to this house in northern Scotland where it's very snowy and they're all broken and they all need time away from life to heal. Nice. And then they all end up in the same house at the same time. And they because they're with each other, their scars heal. Some of them fall in love. This is a genre in the UK that I think we need to bring to the US. Phil, I think we need to – let's write a movie where some people go on vacation and nothing really happens. I bet a studio will make it.
I'm sure they'll make it, especially today. You know, it is interesting that, like, structurally, this is a pretty familiar conceit, certainly for period dramas. But at the same time, I was like, I mean, I was taken with it at times. There were some reveals or some twists, if you will. You know, the Alfred Molina character turns into something that I didn't expect him to turn into in terms of the, you know what I mean? The way he's depicted early on, and then he becomes kind of sees his wife through a different lens and they kind of fall back in love with each other, which is nice. Jim Broadbent playing, as he always does, bordering on a cartoon character.
You know what I find fascinating about this? Yeah. We've covered two Jim Broadbent movies this year, right? Mm-hmm. We've covered this in The Crying Game. Mm-hmm. In both of them, he plays like someone who's coded as like a freaky deaky sex fiend. It's like, who are we going to get? Broadbent. That's who it is. And like, to be clear, in Crying Game, he's just like playing kind of an ambiguously queer guy, but like where you get the sense that he has a lot of sex.
Sure.
And in this movie, he's playing a guy who writes erotica, which this film treats as like, oh my God, I cannot believe that. Crazy. And like, a guy should write erotica. Yeah. Like, there should, maybe don't be weird about it though. Yeah. Like, but yeah, it's so weird though. It is these two movies that code him as like a man with irresponsible sexual appetites. Yep. And like, then they're like, we got to get Broadbent. He's the guy you call.
He's the guy. He's a horny little weirdo in this is basically what it is. He does it perfectly. Let's talk Mike Newell for a second. So Mike Newell directs this film. Mike Newell has a kind of fascinating filmography, if you ask me.
I kind of love Mike Newell.
Crazy. He does a bunch of British films that no one's ever heard of until basically Enchanted April, which puts him on the map. He does a film that I remember as a kid, Into the West. Have you ever seen this movie?
No, I haven't, but the poster for it is great.
Isn't it great? It's like Last Action Hero, but with two Irish kids.
Oh, it's written by Jim Sheridan.
Yeah.
Oh, hey.
So like it's Gabriel Byrne, Alan Barkin. It ultimately, you know, also a Miramax movie. It doesn't really exist, but I remember it as a kid. Then he does Four Weddings and a Funeral, which is obviously gigantic.
Never seen it.
Really?
Never seen it. Yeah. Never seen it.
You kind of have, though.
It was showing at the Alamo, and I kept trying to find a time. Like, now that I have a baby and a job, I have so much less time to just do stuff.
Yeah, that's the truth.
I have to work or look at my baby.
Yeah, it's bullshit. Four Weddings and a Funeral is fine. Notting Hill, I think, is infinitely superior to it. And they're kind of sort of similar movies, obviously both written by Richard Curtis. Then he does An Awfully Big Adventure, which is a movie that I don't really know. It's a coming-of-age film with Alan Rickman and Hugh Grant. Then he does Donnie Brasco.
Sure.
Good movie, like an underrated movie. Then he does Pushing Tim, a movie we covered on 99, which is pretty fucking crazy. I feel like you're a Mona Lisa Smile stan. Am I making that
up? Oh, God, I hate Mona Lisa Smile. I hate it. I did this thing in my newsletter where I watch Kirsten Dunst movies and Natalie Portman movies because it's, you know, whatever. I'm roughly the same age as them. So they were like the girls I could look at on screen growing up. And so I paired Mona Lisa Smile and Cold Mountain because they both came out in 2003 with Oscar ambitions. And I don't really like Cold Mountain. I think that's a huge mess of a movie, really? But like, yeah, I have. How recently have you watched it, Phil?
Pretty recently, like within the last 6 to 8 months.
The Confederacy is like, you know, I think the way that that movie handles what the Confederacy stood for is fucking strange.
Sure, that's fair. That's fair. It's not interested in that. The thing,
it's not. It's also like the stuff, like it's episodic by its nature. Mm-hmm. And so, some of the episodes are better than others, but like, you know, the stuff with Brendan Gleeson, I was so bored by. I think Renee Zellweger is good, but also like so ridiculous. But anyway, the point is I find Cold Mountain a messy movie that I don't really like. Infinitely better than Mona Lisa Smile. At least,
and Natalie is very good in it in her one sequence.
Yeah, at least like Cold Mountain has like a thing it's trying to do, a point it's trying to make.
Yes.
I find a lot of that point, especially with the virtue of time having passed, kind of risible, but at least it's doing a thing. I wish it was not Minghella's last movie. I wish he had like made another movie so that a different one could be his last movie. But yeah,
it wasn't his last movie. Breaking and Entering was his last movie.
Oh,
movie
fuck.
That doesn't exist.
Yeah, right. I was going to, I mean, he also, he did make the film length number one ladies detective agency pilot.
He did. I'm a Minghella apologist. He's made, I think people are, I think
every one of his movies I've seen, but that one. I think that one's a mess. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I assume that someday maybe we cover Cold Mountain, which I'm curious to see how that.
They piss on our heads and say it's raining, but they made the rain. I just conflated Judge Judy and Cold Mountain.
Just fine. That's fine. I'm into it. So the other thing that should be said about Mike Newell's directing career is he does do a Harry Potter film. He does Goblet of Fire.
Sure.
Which,
why not?
I actually quite like. Have you seen that one? I know that you stopped watching them at a certain point.
I stopped watching them after Order of the Phoenix, because like I liked Order of the Phoenix. I thought it was good. I just like, I got to a point where I think I got busy at the AV Club, so like I wasn't seeing as many movies. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, they kept hiring David Yates. And for me, the appeal of the Potter films was a different director comes in and does their take on these characters. And I had wanted to see that continue. And once they were just like, this is our guy, we found the guy who I think is quite good at what he does. I just was like, eh, whatever. And I always meant to go back and catch up. And then instead, J.K. Rowling lost her mind. So I've never caught up. I assume that I will someday for some reason. Actually, no, because the last two are not released.
They're after 2009. So
I have seen all three Fantastic Beasts films.
Jesus. I agree with you in the sense that the Columbus to Cuarón to Newell and then to Yates is an interesting kind of moment in the series. And I do actually think that Goblet of Fire, which people kind of sleep on within the series, is, I love they're all like shaggy and weirdly like going through puberty. And it's all like kind of the messiness of all like, and it's got some amazing sequences in it. It's like the kind of the you get drag, like it's kind of the biggest feeling movie in the series in a weird way. I think
some of that is like they knew that was the book when Harry Potter became Harry Potter.
Correct.
Like that was the one that was super long, sold a billion copies. J.K. Rowling no longer had anyone editing her, so it's like very strange and repetitive. And a lot of the time when people like pull out prejudicial or bigoted things that were sort of in the subtext of her books, they're pulling from Goblet of Fire.
Oh, interesting. Like, okay.
Yeah. But I of the Potter films I've seen, that's I prefer it to both of the Columbuses. I think I prefer Azkaban is the one in that series I think is great. Yeah. And then I liked Order of the Phoenix slightly better. But like I think all of those are good. And then the Columbuses, I'm kind of like,
Yeah, it's interesting to this is our paths. This is when he comes to the world. And then
he was born on the set of this film.
Yeah, it's interesting, right?
No, but he was born like a full grown man.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
Then he makes Prince of Persia, a movie that I love talking about because no one remembers that it exists.
I have watched that movie. I have watched that movie.
$200 million to make. And Jake Gyllenhaal, you know, shakes his fist at that movie every time that he can.
Movie should have worked. Like that's a movie like that. I love the reason I saw that movie is I love those video games. Like those are some video games I adore. The idea of behind them that is like when you like die, you can rewind a little bit. Perfect movie idea. But yeah, I think Gyllenhaal's all wrong for that part.
I mean, Jill, I think I'll be perfectly
setting
honest.
Aside that he's an extremely white man. He's all wrong for it.
I mean, the cultural appropriation aside, I'll just say that I've not seen the whole movie. I think I've watched probably 20 minutes of it at some point in my life.
Yeah.
And the Bruckheimer of it all makes sense. The Disney of it all makes sense, right? Like it's a video game that was, you know, that was quite beloved. It should have worked. It cost too much money. And ultimately, like it also was pretty joyless. Mike Newell's not really the right guy for it. Like it needed to feel more like Pirates of the Caribbean. And instead it felt like kind of a stodgy middle of the road action movie.
Yeah. I think they did really think it was going to be their next Pirates. Yes. And I do think like it was one of those movies that got delayed because the 2007-2008 strike meant Correct. That like they spread a bunch of slow. I think it was supposed to come out in 2009. They pushed it to 2010. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is just kind of lays there. I like both
Kingsley and Gemma Arterton.
I like Gemma Arterton. I like Jake Gyllenhaal. I don't really like them in this movie. It feels like they're not used well. Alanis Morissette wrote the theme song for it.
She did. Okay. Yeah. The other thing that I think is worth noting that I didn't know until I was looking at his filmography is how many movies Newell EPs on.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if it's because he was going to do them and then didn't. But like 200 Cigarettes, Best Laid Plans, High Fidelity, Traffic. I mean, yeah. That's pretty crazy.
It is wild to me that he so when it's a British film, I'm just like, OK, he probably, sure. you know, like he probably used his name to get like I Capture the Castle made or whatever. Right. But yeah, it is like he must have been signed to like High Fidelity at some point.
Because then it's Stephen Frears and Mike Newell, who, if I'm being honest. A little interchangeable at times, like could kind of be the same filmmakers.
I much prefer Frears. I think
he has more movies.
So. I think Frears has like a thing that he does. I think he's very good with ensembles.
Yes.
They both are to some degree, but I think that Frears like is very good at like, you know, finding talent, things like that. Mm-hmm. I thought when you said, here's the thing I didn't realize, I thought you were going to say that he directed the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, which I know is a favorite of yours.
I didn't know he did that.
No, but you like every time you watch that film, which again is a favorite of yours, you're like, when the directed by credit comes up, you cover your eyes because you're like, I don't want to know. Don't want the magic spoiled.
I mean, yeah, it's here's what I'll say about both of them. And I don't mean to suggest that they're interchangeable necessarily, but I do feel like they're both a little bit chameleon-esque in terms of that they can exist in a bunch of different genres. But they're also a little bit anonymous is the thing, too, where like they're not filmmakers that you're like, oh, well, this is a Mike Newell's joint or this is a Stephen Frears movie. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society film has a screenplay by Kevin Hood, who's a British playwright I've never heard of. Mm-hmm. Don Roos.
Oh, interesting. Who, of Bounce fame. Know,
yes. And Tom Bazooka of Fargo. He worked on Fargo, okay. But he also like did The Family Stone. Like,
oh, right. Your favorite movie.
Yeah, my favorite movie. So like they threw a bunch of like pretty big name writers at this movie.
I have no idea what it even is. Could I tell you if you
well, it's one of your favorites, as we know.
So you mentioned the cinematography. It is worth noting. This was definitely shot for television, and my guess is it was full frame at the time too. So these close-ups are like just like right up in their fucking grill.
I like one of the first things you see is Alfred Molina's lips just eating a thing, and you're like, why am I looking at this? No.
Why am I so close to this man's face?
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Oh, the other thing that I mentioned to you that I texted you, which I kind of love, is that U.S. President George H.W. Bush watched this movie to cheer himself up directly after losing the 1992 election.
Sure. I think that makes sense. You know, that's the kind of thing.
It makes as much sense as anything. I just think it's funny. This movie comes out in July. The election is in November. And I'm seeing him just putting a VHS into his VCR and just sitting back with some tea and watching Enchanted April. Good for him.
Yeah, to it. Yeah. You know, that's when men were men. That's when we had a country.
That's when we had a country. Here's a question for you. Would you go up to a complete stranger at your quote unquote woman's club
yes.
and just see if she'd want to rent a castle together?
I have done this. I mean, I haven't done that, but like, when I came out, I was like very desperate for, I mostly had had women friends before I came out, but like, I was very desperate to like have friends I had made as a woman who'd only ever known me as a woman. Most of my like best friends now are fall in that category. But like, I would just like, people would just like, I'd be talking with them and we'd be vibing and I'd be like, do you want to be friends? Let's be best friends. And they would say, sure. Every time. Because I think people appreciate the direct approach.
I agree.
And I agree. Yeah, that's like my my dear, wonderful friend, also named Libby, not my wife. She like, we were just sitting together at this party for some other people, and we were sitting across from each other talking about our, you know, whatever. This was when I was pretty sure I was never going to make it as a writer. And she's was just like, do you ever feel... I'm trying to remember her exact words. Do you ever feel bound by dreams you had when you were 16? And I was like, let's be best friends. And now it's, we are.
There's just something. I mean, when Lottie goes up to Rose, it's raining outside. They're both at the women's yeah. club. They're reading yeah. the newspapers. They're both in these like foppish hats that they've got on their heads, and they just look miserable. And she's just like, do you want to rent a castle together? And I'm like, yes, do this. This is great. You guys need this in your life.
I can't believe you've never done this at your men's club.
Well, yeah, I haven't. But I mean, it is just interesting that you could write a book, you could write a movie on such a thin premise is ultimately what it comes down to.
Again, it is like, okay, so we have the rom-com here, which just kind of repeats the same story. You know, there's like five different rom-coms and we just keep doing them. Mm-hmm. That's what this is in the UK. There's this whole subgenre of, I have a castle. You want to go there? And then they do. I mean, and that's crazy. What happens.
I'm into it. I don't know. I just, it takes some time for them to get enough people together to go to the castle. But it's nice. Polly Walker, who we have talked about briefly from Patriot Games.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
She was the...
Her finest role.
Yeah. The evil IRA person, sort of honey pot. Is that what they call them? Or honey?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sounds right.
Yeah. The other thing too that I realize is I have not seen many Joan Plowright movies. Have oh, you? Sure. I mean, I watched I Love You to Death because obviously they covered it on Blank Check. She pops up in Last Action Hero. The thing I remember her most from is Avalon, which is the uh-huh. Levinson film, which I think we both enjoy.
Yes.
So I have this like association with her. She looks kind of like my grandmother did, and in Avalon she's playing a woman similar to my grandmother, so she's got like this association in my brain of like Polish Jewish grandmother, which is not what Joan Plowright is, but that's where my brain goes. Does that make sense?
I have seen a fair bit of her work.
Okay.
It seems like she was more of a state, like she did yes. so much stage work.
Yes.
But yeah, I've seen, you know, she's in Moby Dick, which is a movie I watched. She's in like a nothing part. So I didn't sure. like say that's Joan Plowright, like Leo pointing at the TV. But I like the film of Equus, which I've seen her in. I obviously Avalon. Weirdly, I have seen her several times in the major motion picture Dennis the Menace.
I was gonna say, do you remember her as Mrs. Wilson?
Yeah, absolutely. She does seem to be like they're like, okay,
we need an old lady.
Yeah, you need an old lady. We're gonna get you.
I mean, I vaguely remember her in 101 Dalmatians.
Yeah.
The Glenn Close movie.
Yeah.
You know what? Tea with Mussolini we covered in 99, so I do remember her in that.
Yeah, yeah.
That might be when I stopped remembering her and things.
She like, okay, so in 2006, she's in Curious George, and in 2008, she's in The Spiderwick Chronicles. Her characters are named Victoria Plushbottom and Aunt Lucinda Spiderwick. I'm guessing the second, the casting agent saw those names. Yep. They were like, get Joan. We got to get Joan.
Got to get Joan. I mean, she's one of the titular Spiderwicks. I mean, she has to be in this.
What is that even about? What are the Spiderwick Chronicles?
There's many of them, though.
Let's not find out.
We don't need to find out. I do love that Joan Plowright's still with us, though. God bless her.
Let's have her on the pod. We're recording this like 2 days before it's released. I'm going to see if I can get Joan on.
Listen, Joan might want to do it. I mean, truthfully, you know, I'm looking at this plot summary and I'm seeing my notes and there's not a ton to talk about here.
This movie is good. It's a little snoozy,
it's very snoozy.
I get why you'd watch it after losing a presidential election. It is kind of a nice soak in like, you know, you're sitting in, it's not even like a hot tub. Nope. It's just kind of like
lukewarm.
It's a nice pool that's been warmed by the sun.
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
And so it's like 6 p.m. and now the water's warmer than the air because of the sun. It's retained the sunlight. That's what this movie is. You're just kind of floating there.
You're kind of floating. And like so many books and movie adaptations of books of this period all sort of have similar turns in terms of the romantic relationships.
Yeah.
So it's not as though there's like any big surprises per se. Like, you know, what's her face? Caroline falls for George because George doesn't fawn all over her. Like, that's it. Like, that's the turn. Yeah. It's stuff like that where you're like, okay, sure. I mean, whatever. Everyone is better off at the end of this movie in the sense that they've all learned something about themselves. They've all moved on. I'll say this. The final image was kind of cool, which is basically Fisher. Is that her name? Mrs. Fisher has this like cane that she uses, but she doesn't need it anymore after her time in Italy. She kind of like plants it in the ground and then all these like vines grow around it and it becomes like the basis of like a tree, which is the final shot. And you're like, that's kind of cool.
That's nice. The visual grammar of this film is actually pretty sophisticated, especially when you consider it was shot for television, probably again full frame, on 16. Joan Plowright's great. I think it's worth seeing for her. Yeah. All the performers are great. Miranda Richardson, of course, from the film Damage, which we just recently covered. She's having a good time. I will say this. I was like watching this kind of late at night and I was watching it on Pluto TV. So there's ads. So it was longer than I expected it to be. And I like, cause both the nice thing about this and Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, the one thing they have in common is they're both short, like 87 minutes long. Jim Broadbent showed up in Italy and I was like, oh fuck, here's the plot. The plot's kicking in. He's there. His mistress and his wife are both there. Coincidentally, there's going to be some mishaps. Yep. There's going to be some mistaken identities. I checked the running time. There was 10 minutes left. I was like, what?
Yeah, it's a weird movie. I don't think anyone needs to run out to watch it, but I'd probably give it. I came into this at like a 59. I think I'm probably sticking around there. Like, I wouldn't say don't watch this movie, but I wouldn't say like you need to watch Enchanted April, but you know.
I'm going to give it a 67. Okay. I enjoyed it well enough, but again, I don't think it's a must see, but like, you know, it's a fun little nice little time.
Sure.
That's like a 3.25, which sounds about right to me.
That sounds right. Yeah. I mean, listen, both of these films, they'll never enter the transmit my mind again. I don't imagine. I don't think I'll be thinking about these films once we log off here.
I forgot I was going to request that we not rate both, but instead rate an average of the two. Let me see what that would be.
Yeah. What would that be?
Let me pull up my, so we both gave it like you gave the, 59 and 21.
Yeah. All
right, I'm pulling up a calculator here. Cause my brain no longer
it's
does
like
math.
Somewhere in the high 30s, I'm assuming.
Okay. So 59 plus 21 equals, it would be 40 on the dot.
40, sure.
And mine was 67 plus
21. You're
going to
be in the high 40s.
Yeah. I'm 44. So, yeah.
That feels right.
Whoever does the wiki, I don't know, like the mystery person.
Sure.
just put the averages so people have to listen to the
episode. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What, is there anything else you want to say about these movies, Emily? Do you have any other
Not thoughts? At all. I was like looking at the list of movies we have yet to cover because we're running short on time. This incarnation of the podcast is going to be wrapping up. And I just was sort of like, what are some other like wild ass double features we could do? I think we got to do.
Oh, okay.
Farewell. I think we got to do The Long Day Closes, the great Terrence Davis film,
for sure.
And Lethal Weapon 3.
You want to do that?
Let's do it.
All right.
It feels like such a like Terrence Davis is one of my favorite filmmakers. He's a seminal queer filmmaker. Like he recently died. I was gutted when he died. He makes beautiful, thoughtful films about growing up queer. It feels like such an insult to his legacy to pair that with Lethal Weapon 3, but I think we got to do it.
I think we got to do it. It's the only way. It's also the only Lethal Weapon film you will have seen, which also is perfect.
And it'll be the only Terrence Davies film you'll have seen.
Correct.
So
it all works out. There you go. It's perfect. Next week, or I actually would say later this week on Friday.
Maybe this week.
It is this week. My Cousin Vinny with Katie Rich.
Hey. Yeah.
The best.
Another the good best movie. Another good movie. Said as though we discussed two good movies instead of just like one that was fine.
This, you know, My Cousin Vinny is a movie that one of the bigger 92 films, not necessarily, it did fine in its day, but it does feel as though like the love legacy. For it and the legacy for it is and we talk about this a little bit in the episode, but it's worth saying too that like, as you're watching the film, it's a pretty like, it's a small movie, right? Like it's kind of just a solid video store comedy rental that you can understand did, you know, quite well in its moment. And it's interesting that you don't see movies like that blow up in 2024 is kind of what I'm getting at. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Which I think is the Marissa Tomei effect for sure, because her role has become this icon, but still.
I do think that like we are in an era where this stuff is starting to happen again, where a movie comes to theaters, does okay, and then like hits streaming and suddenly everybody's talking about it. It is that like weird Netflix effect of anything can go on Netflix and just randomly become the biggest movie ever made for like a week.
Yep.
And it's so fascinating to me that this sort of keeps happening. But like there's this, the example I always give is like The Northman. Kind of bombed in theaters, but because it got that big promotional campaign, it did so well on VOD that it ultimately like made a profit. And it sounds like a pretty handsome one. And like, yeah, this just like this thing where releasing it in theaters, even if it bombs, often ends up being a great advertisement for like the long tail of the film. I am glad we're sort of getting back to that.
I'm curious about your thoughts on this. And
just like Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, My Cousin Vinny has a great where they say the name of the movie.
They do.
You know, yeah.
Hey, My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
But it's perfect. What I was gonna ask is, I think it's interesting we exist, and this is indicative of just the fucking internet being a terrible place sometimes and I guess a wonderful place at others, which is that you'll find movies. Like a generation discovers My Cousin Vinny, for instance, right?
Sure.
And then it becomes this thing. Like Mona Lisa Vito becomes this icon and everybody loves her. Well deserved. But then you also have the opposite effect where like some asshole on Twitter decides, you know what? Fuck William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. And then for a week, you've got a bunch of people just clowning on a movie, just arbitrarily, it seems, that was like great in its moment and still is great. And people just decide to like shit on it. I just don't get it.
You know what I wish? I wish that we would not care when people do that, you know?
Fair. Don't give it oxygen is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's not even don't give it oxygen. It's just like people are allowed to be wrong. You know?
Well, that's true too. Sure.
Especially like movies and sports, two things where it kind of doesn't matter. Sure. You know, if somebody doesn't like William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, I think they're wrong, but fine, whatever. You know, at least they're not like saying, you know, horrible, like awful genocidal things.
Fair.
You know?
That's fair. That's a completely fair thing. I more than anything, I brought it up just because I do think it's interesting how
Yeah.
I mean, it's a double-edged sword. There's an arbitrary kind of component on both sides of this. And some of it has to do with the attention span. Some of it has to do with just a generation that has not been exposed to, you know, a million movies. And then all of a sudden, someone from Gen Z watches something and all of a sudden is like, this is great or this is terrible. And then it becomes a whole fucking thing. I just think it's interesting. Whatever.
And you know what, though? Now we're having to, like, the first few takes are rolling out about my kids' generation, Generation Alpha.
Generation Alpha?
Yeah.
Does your child have something to say about that? Or
No, they're barely verbal. No, I just like there were like an Apple News alert went across my phone because it knows I'm a mom. So it's like, sure, you might want to hear this. It's like Generation Alpha is feral and barely, Generation Alpha is feral and barely, like, they can't read, basically. Barely literate. There we go.
Right.
And I just was like, is that true? That sounds like the thing that people say about every generation once they turn 13. And people are like, oh my fucking God.
But to be fair, your child also cannot read and is barely verbal. So I mean, there is something to that. I mean,
and is feral, you know.
It's not a completely off-base description.
But it is this thing of, like, it's always the same takes. It's always the same, like, when they become teenagers, everyone's like, oh my God, they don't respect authority. What the fuck is happening? Yeah. Or it's like, oh my God, they have a weird relationship to technology. But they said that about us. They said that about the boomers. They said that about, fuck, people have been saying that about teenagers and 20-somethings since we've had people. Yeah. And like, it's just literally, I wish we could all just settle down and admit that teenagers and 20-somethings are annoying, and that's all we're talking about.
Well, it's funny you bring this up, because I was texting with Kenny about this the other night, about we've been scared as an industry, and I would say as perhaps as a species, of like YouTube and TikTok and a generation that has given up on narrative or given up on investing in stories and what have you, which is nonsense, right? Like they're watching Gilmore Girls, you know, and Grey's Anatomy and Friends as much as they possibly can. What we're really talking about is the attention span and the way you view the world in your teens and early 20s is a fucking disaster. So like, that's just what it is.
I think that, like, yeah, that's always been the case. People said that about MTV. Now kids can't focus, like MTV editing. We're already seeing the ways that TikTok and YouTube are influencing how we tell stories. A lot of recent Netflix films are framed for TikTok. Mm-hmm. Like this is so like everything's happening right here in the center of the frame, and the frame continues to extend, but it's like very weird and inert. Yep. What I do think Hollywood is going to have to grapple with that it hasn't entirely is the degree to which video games are like a huge important thing to people my age, but especially people younger than me. And like the way that video games tell stories is fundamentally different from how films and television tell stories, just in a way that TV is different from how tell stories differently from film. And like we had to grapple with that. I do think the industry thinks it can just sort of be like, now we're going to make a Mario movie. But I think there is a fundamental storytelling quality that games have that we have yet to fully figure out. And I think once we do, we're going to be fine. So let's just do that.
We'll get there. Well, guys, this has been obviously our episode on Enchanted April and Stop Where My Mom Will Shoot.
Are we talking Hero? Because Stephen Frears directed that. So we can talk about my boy, Stephen Frears. I mean,
have you seen Hero?
No.
I saw it in the theater with my mom.
I mean, of course you did.
So that happened. It's a weird movie. I'm not opposed to watching Hero. This has been, I mean, a joy as always, Emily.
Always. And if you're still listening to this, please, whatever, go to your social media platform of choice. Write to Phil and say, I'm a potato peeler too, because you all love that movie.
This has been great.
Wonderful. Podcast Nuggets. Podcast Nuggets. 1992. Podcast Nuggets. Podcast Nuggets. 1992. 1992.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.